Welcome to the Wonder Women Tech Show, where we highlight, celebrate, and amplify global leaders who are creating impact. We humanize our role models and curate a culture of vulnerability and belonging. This is a show designed to innovate, empower, and ignite. I'm your host, Lisa Mae Brunson. Hello, innovators. It's Lisa Mae Brunson with the Wonder Women Tech Show. Today's guest is someone I absolutely admire who is going hard in the diversity, equity, and inclusion space, also known as DEI, and whom I have the honor of calling a peer and an ally. As CEO of Impovia, formerly Change Catalyst, Melinda Brianna Epler works with her clients and partners to solve diversity and inclusion together, using her background in storytelling, behavioral science, and large-scale culture change. She is a strategic advisor and learning and development partner for organizations around the world. She also co-founded Tech Inclusion, a series of global solutions-focused conferences where she partnered with over 450 tech companies and community organizations and hosted over 50 solution-focused diversity and inclusion events. Previously, Melinda was a marketing executive and award-winning documentary filmmaker. Melinda is a TED speaker who speaks, advises, and writes about empathy, allyship, sustainability, trust, psychological safety, microaggressions, inclusive leadership, and how to drive change. She is the author of How to Be an Ally and the host of the popular Leading with Empathy and Allyship podcast. She has spoken on hundreds of stages worldwide, including South by Southwest, Grace Hopper, Wisdom 2.0, the World Bank, White House, Clinton Foundation, Black Enterprise, Google, and more. Welcome to the show, Melinda.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Oh my gosh. I'm so excited to see you. I have not seen you in forever. I think the pandemic was when we last set eyes on each other.
Mm-hmm.
But our history does go back to when I attended your very first Tech Inclusion conference,
Yeah. Which
I absolutely loved. And I still have friends from that event.
Mm-hmm.
And then I invited you to speak at our very first Wonder Women Tech National Conference in Long Beach back in 2016. So we've been rolling with each other for a while.
Yeah, almost 10 years. The world is different too.
Oh my gosh, oof. It's been just such a journey. Okay, let's talk about this. I remember I met Pastor Brian because I was on a panel with him at Tech Inclusion. And I think I was also with Morgan from AfroTech
on
that same panel. Yeah. And who would have known that the panel of us sitting there having this dynamic conversation centered around DEI solutions, who would have known that the world would look so different just years later, where we're not only having some of the same conversations we were having there, but we're kind of backwards. We're kind of struggling to find ourselves again in this space.
Mm-hmm.
Who would have thought we would be here?
Yeah. I think way back then we were really naive and thought that we would work our way out of a job. I didn't think we would be forced away out of jobs.
God, that hurts my heart. Melinda, that hurts my heart.
I know. And it's not that the work will, I do think that maybe we'll get into this a little bit later. I do think it's not that bad. The work is just going to change based on the way the world is right now.
I am excited to dive into that because I hold the same faith and hope. But before we do dive into that, I want to take it back further in time because I want to learn about your childhood.
Mm.
I want you to share where you grew up and what your upbringing was like.
Oh, wow. Okay. So way back. Well, I was born in San Francisco, grew up in the Bay Area in Oakland, and then moved to Seattle when I was still pretty young. One of the things that I didn't realize at the time that was unique is that, and I didn't learn this until much later in my life, that it was unique is that I grew up in very diverse neighborhoods, which a lot of people, especially white people, do not. And I think that shaped me in ways that I had no idea it was shaping me. I went to public schools. I went to schools where, as a white person, I was the minority, actually. And so in high school, realized I wanted to change the world, make the world a better place with my life. And so ever since then, I have worked to create change. So my life has been focused on that. When I went to school, I studied cultural anthropology, really understanding how change happens in societies, how you create change in societies, and then moved into art that had a social change component, and quickly moved into documentary filmmaking. So I went to USC Film School and became a documentary filmmaker for a while, lived in LA, and then started using those storytelling skills to really drive behavior change. I developed a consulting company that worked with large brands, NGOs, and nonprofits, and larger Fortune 500 companies that were working on social impact and helping them to develop their stories around that social impact and creating change through the work that they wanted to do. And fast forward, I ended up being recruited by one of my clients. I became an executive working at an engineering firm, an international engineering firm. And I was the head of marketing and culture, and I also worked with healthcare systems, big healthcare systems, to drive behavior change around energy, waste, and water use. Worked with the American Hospital Association on developing a industry-wide program to help healthcare facilities reduce their energy and their waste and their water use. And I'm still working now today. There's 2,700 hospital systems in the program. At the same time, I was always doing really great work. I was feeling really good about the work. And also, I was not in a healthy workplace environment. I was in a toxic workplace environment. I was the only woman on a leadership team of 19. And it was not a good place for me. I experienced microaggressions, bullying, harassment, and some other things that really initially drew me into kind of a deep, dark place. I was like, what's wrong with me? I've been successful in everything that I'm doing, and yet here I feel awful. And then I started reading and really understanding what was happening was the microaggressions, was the biases, was the bullying, was the little sabotage actions and things that were happening around me. And I worked to create change in that culture, but to be honest, they weren't quite ready for that. And so I left to start Change Catalyst, which is now in Povia, to really address diversity, equity, and inclusion in the tech industry. So that's here I am. 10 years later.
Well, you talk about growing up in this diverse community, which I think that is so key when you're being shaped and molded as a child, as a teenager, as a young adult, and you develop ideas about the world that you might not be able to develop if you were living in a much more sheltered environment or on a neighborhood, on a block where everyone looks like you and thinks like you. So going back to like when you were that child, when you were that teenager in these diverse communities, what do you feel were some of like your early indicators that something wasn't right in the world, that people that didn't look like you needed more support or frameworks created where we could have a world of inclusion?
You know, just thinking back right now, I would say that the indicators that I had initially were the kids with disabilities, youth who were LGBTQIA+ that couldn't come out, or if they did, like I had a friend on the soccer team, and she came out to me, and then the next day her father had yanked her from school because he didn't think she was safe now that she had come out to anybody. And kids that were bullied in school were often the kids with disabilities, or they just didn't have the same opportunities. And so kind of looking back, those were the first indicators just right around me. And then I would say, you know, in high school, I looked outward. I had really diverse friends, and we never talked about adversity they were experiencing. So I didn't learn that until I got to college. And I was like, wait a minute. I'm hearing a lot of different things that the meritocracy dissolved when I hit college, really. And then I would also say there were things happening in the world. It was the end of the Cold War. And so there were a lot of scary things happening too in the world. That kind of hate that can turn really into destruction, death, that was something that was pretty top of mind for a lot of people at that time. So,
yeah. Yeah. Those are, it's definitely interesting. You know, when I look back at my childhood and being in middle school and high school, I know I wasn't talking about the things I was going through either. And as you were talking about that, I find it interesting that we are silent. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult for us to share our lived experiences when we are younger. And perhaps it's because we don't know the language. We haven't yet cultivated that sense of understanding of our lived experiences and how systemic racism works or how discrimination works or what bullying means. You know, we're kind of, I'm going to just say, gaslit as kids absolutely. That bullying is a part of the childhood experience mm-hmm. and it shouldn't be.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. It's normalized. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. When I was in elementary school, there was a school that I went to for 1 year and then my parents yanked us out of it, my sister and I out of it, because they felt like it was a racist school, and it was. And that there was definitely overt racism happening between the teachers and the students, and all of the Black kids were bussed into a very white, wealthy, conservative neighborhood, and that there was definitely some friction that was happening there. So there I guess there were some kind of flags in moments in time where I did see that. My parents quickly yanked us out of it. And moved us into a much better place.
So in your educational journey, did you prepare yourself?
Yeah.
You know, what courses did you take to kind of prepare yourself on the journey that you are on today with your career? Or were you entirely looking at doing something completely different?
I went to college and I was like, I'm going to change the world. And now I need to learn how to do it. And
because they'll teach you there, right?
Yes, it's not. I definitely took a lot of classes, a lot of school. I was in school for a long time as I figured out, like, what does that mean? What does that look like? And so I took a lot of literature classes and film classes and learning about different cultures through literature and film at first. Took some environmental science classes. And then I kind of ended up in cultural anthropology with a focus on indigenous cultures because I think initially my thought was there are so many cultures that are dying that need to be preserved, and cultural anthropologists, part of what they do is that they preserve them in books, not right. And so I was like, well, there's all this amazing knowledge, there are amazing people out there that we're losing out on their knowledge, their skills that we'll never get back. And so that was my initial thought, was I'll become an anthropologist. And I really, really deeply enjoyed learning about different cultures in a way that cultural anthropology does, which is to go deep and listen.
Well, okay then. Yeah, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah. And then I realized, you know, after I was almost finished with my degree and I had a couple of electives I had to take, and so I took some art classes and I found out I was really good at it. And so I went from cultural anthropology to fine art. And I moved to New York and became an artist and went to art school and learned how to visually change the way people think and the emotions that they have pretty quickly, which was a really powerful thing to learn. That storytelling element, I think, is really an essential component of what I do and how I do it. It's still today, even though I don't develop art in that same way, that storytelling component was really important. And I learned from there that the visual medium turned into film and how many... the art world is a pretty insular world, and I wanted to affect change with more people. So I went to film school to do that.
I just find it fascinating that you had this like core value statement. So you would eventually launch Change Catalyst, now Impovia, which builds inclusive, innovative ecosystems through training, consulting, and coaching. What has that process been like from startup to global expansion? And I know you pivoted in there somewhere as well.
Yeah. So when we first started back in, 2014, the diversity, equity, inclusion was really, really new. I mean, there were definitely some folks that were working on it, but not a lot. Some companies that had diversity, equity, inclusion individuals working on it, and some ERGs, but not a lot. Not a lot was being done. And so what we realized really early on is that there was a need to really convene the industry to focus on solutions to diversity, equity, and inclusion. There was that was when the Google first released their diversity numbers, and a handful of different tech companies released their numbers. And it was grim. And it was the first time that, like, publicly it was, see, we told you so. Right? The diversity numbers were really awful. And so there were a lot of convenings from, you know, the White House and the SEC and the FCC and the other government organizations, and legislators were convening discussions around it. There were some small events that were working on having conversations around it, but most of what was happening was focused on the problems and kind of even finger pointing and like, this is terrible kind of conversations, which is important. It's important to understand where it all came from. And also, it's important to start focusing on solutions. And so we built a conference to really convene the industry to focus on solutions to diversity, equity, and inclusion, to start to develop some best practices and to really drive change across the industry. And it took a lot of work to make that happen, because in the beginning, we had to find all of the people to bring together. We also had to build trust with those folks. The people that were working on D&I and their organizations were doing their work in silos. There was a theory, and many tech companies thought that their D&I people were kind of their secret sauce to the talent problem, basically, that this was going to be a window into talent that nobody else could have. And so as a result, they were working in silos and not talking to each other and kind of reinventing the wheel, a lot of reinventing the wheel. And so we had to build trust with them to come out of those silos and talk about it publicly. And start to, you know, talk about what wasn't working, what is working, and really develop some best practices. And so, because so many folks were still focused on the recruiting side, we also created a career fair. And so that was where we started, was really convening the industry. We mapped out the industry. We developed a lot of relationships with people so that they would come and really deeply talk about it. And then we really worked hard to develop an inclusive space to do that. And so we did that in 2015 all the way through 2021. And we took our conference, you know, it was the first one sold out. We had to turn people away. It was really, you know, it did catalyze change in the industry, and people walked away different from it. And
I was one of those people.
Yeah, thank you. And developed some best practices, and we're no longer in silos. The diversity, equity, and inclusion folks don't generally work in silos anymore. They really collaborate, talk with each other about what's working, what's not, and so on. And so we achieved what we wanted to achieve and realized we needed to do more of it. A lot of desire for us to do more of it. And so we continued, we expanded to New York. We also did an Ability in Tech Summit the next year as well. We did one in Austin alongside South by Southwest. So that was the next year. And then the year following was right after the election, where Trump was elected. And the Obama administration done a lot of work on, this is a long answer, is this okay?
No, I mean, but it's the impact that you guys created through your work.
Yeah.
It's perfect.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, yeah. So the Obama administration had actually done a lot of work to drive change around diversity, equity, and inclusion. They convened leaders. They convened all of us. A lot of us went to the White House multiple times because they wanted to know what to do and they wanted to hold companies accountable for the change. And then when
Those were the good old days.
Yeah. And then the Trump administration came in and it was very different. It was the opposite. All of that was shut down and the diversity, equity, and inclusion was kind of pushed away. And we also realized something in that election, that we had been focusing on the tech centers, the big cities. And so we wanted to focus on some of the early stage tech regions. So we went to smaller cities. We went to Nashville, Chicago. I think we went to a total of 8 different cities. We also went to London, went to Melbourne. So we really, you know, made this more of a global conversation, and we're able to reach the tech industry when it was earlier in creation in some of these cities, where we could affect change more easily because they were just starting to create it. So now they're creating it with a lens of diversity, equity, and inclusion. It was actually really powerful and important and really highlighted some activists and advocates and connected them with government officials and tech companies. And it helped create this community in these different spaces to really drive change in a different way. And, you know, we kept going from there. And then the pandemic hit. And every time there's some kind of a contraction in the economy, every time there's kind of a change in the world, diversity, equity, and inclusion tends to contract within companies. And it's not highlighted. And so in addition to everybody grappling with the pandemic itself, the diversity, equity, and inclusion work kind of quieted during the pandemic as well.
It was the first to not just be quieted, but completely disbanded, mm-hmm. weaponized,
yeah.
and targeted.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because
absolutely.
Now we're under attack. And now it's that, oh, we're preaching woke ideals, which what does that even mean? You know, it's become very devastatingly scapegoat and like, nope, you can't do that. You can't touch it. I mean, we have Elon Musk making these very public statements about how we need to kill it. And we have Florida education voting to limit the amount of educational funding that goes into these programs. And so how do you feel, because clearly we've all had to shift and pivot post-pandemic. You created a new entity in Povia. I also found myself reimagining Wonder Women Tech literally from the basic foundation. Also in 2014, we're celebrating our 10-year anniversary, to creating initiatives that are careful not to poke the bear per se, utilizing words that have become weaponized, but tripling down on the work and impact that we need to do in these spaces. So what do you feel is our power move in this industry moving forward? You know, in the wake of this information that feels disempowering, what do you feel our power moves are?
Well, one thing is that we moved away from events. We have been starting to focus more and more on consulting and learning development and coaching anyway, and fully pivoted during the pandemic. The coaching, I think, is really important because the one-on-one connections and helping leaders to really deeply understand issues where they feel it's safe to explore. And I would say that in the last 2 years, our work has really shifted to focus more on building empathy and understanding. Because when you have this polarization within the workplace, if you keep pushing things that activate that polarization, you're not going to succeed in solving the problem. You know, and there's a lot of people that are very passionate deeply about equity and about justice and about anti-racism and anti-ableism and all of the isms within our workplaces. And that's really important. And there are a lot of different ways to get at that without being so polarizing. And, you know, I think that if we keep pushing and we keep pushing an agenda that polarizes, we're just never going to solve the problem. And so what we have been focusing more on is building empathy and understanding as a way in, because when you get people in a group and they're all going like this and are really like actively opposed to diversity, equity, and inclusion, when they walk in and then they realize, we're just talking about empathy. We're talking about understanding each other. Let's start there. By the end, they're walking out and they're like, I fundamentally understand that person and what they're going through in a much deeper way because I let my guard down, because suddenly I didn't have to talk about other people. I could talk about myself and I could listen to other people, right? There's a way to get at the same outcome through multiple different angles. I will say, when back to the company that I left when I was an executive, they weren't ready to talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion. They were like, the CFO literally took me aside and said, you got to stop with this woman thing. I mean, they weren't ready to talk about that. But what I did do was I created a wellness program. We created a mindfulness program, created an emotional intelligence program with leadership. All of those things fundamentally get to the same issues, but we didn't talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion. So I think that we have to just let go of the terms that divide us and focus on the work that unites us, ultimately.
I love you. As I'm listening, I'm like, yes, 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 because I'm same. You know, like, we are so aligned in our leadership impact and how we are choosing to have these kinds of conversations, bring in that empathy, bring in that understanding and compassion and opportunity to listen. I love that. That's what I do. That's what I'm passionate about. We need to operate from this space of connection and unity versus attacking each other for not getting it quote unquote right or for having a different belief system than the other does. And to your point, there's many inroads to inclusion. There are many. There's not just one road for us to get it together, right? And I appreciate that you've chosen some very core elements of what make us human to connect each other. So we're going to take a break for today's Pioneering Women segment. Today's Pioneering Woman is Martha Costin. Martha Costin was born Martha Hunt in 1826 in Baltimore, Maryland. She eloped at 15
with Benjamin Costin, a 21-year-old inventor who later joined the U.S. Navy's scientific laboratory to develop a signaling rocket. In 1848, Martha was left with four children and no income when her husband died as the result of working with chemical fumes. While putting her late husband's affairs in order, she discovered his notes on night signaling and worked on that idea for the next 10 years. She had a major breakthrough in 1858 while watching a fireworks display. And in 1859, she was granted a patent for a pyrotechnic night signal and code system in the name of her late husband as the inventor, while she was named the administratrix. The system was a type of semaphore where the colored flares burned in various combinations to represent numerals 0 to 9 and letters A and P. The U.S. Navy used the flares during the American Civil War, and they were also adopted by other navies around the world. In 1871, Martha was granted patents for improvements to the system, this time in her name alone. She was inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame in 2006. Thank you for your pioneering contributions, Martha Costin. Hello, innovators. We are back with Melinda Brianna Epler. Melinda, you wrote a book.
I did.
I'm so excited, and I can't wait to read my copy. Can you share more with us about the inspiration behind the book, and how can you be an ally?
Yeah, so my inspiration was, having worked on diversity, equity, and inclusion in companies for many years now, I realized that it's not enough to have diversity, equity, and inclusion practitioners, the few folks that are really driving diversity, equity, and inclusion in a company. It really takes all of us working to create change, because, you know, we're working to create systems change and culture change. That's all of us. And so that means we have to change, each of us has to change our own actions. And that requires some learning and unlearning and relearning. And, you know, I talked about my own education. There's a lot of gaps in our understanding of history and present as well. And so some of that means we need to unlearn some of what we thought we knew, unlearn some of those biases that we might have learned from culture, from our educators, from our friends and family as well, and relearn from different perspectives. And then so the book takes you through seven different steps for being an ally. Starts with learning, unlearning, relearning, doing no harm. So really understanding what biases are and interrupting them in ourselves. The same for microaggressions, really deeply understanding what microaggressions are that we might be saying or doing that are unintentionally harming folks, and not do those. And then advocating for people, really going deep into how can we be each other's champions? How can we use our power, our privilege, our influence to really open doors for the people around us, especially people with underrepresented identities? What can we do to really drive change by making introductions, by recognizing people's accomplishments, by recommending them for jobs and speaking opportunities and leadership opportunities? Then from there, interrupting biases and microaggressions and the role that we all have to play there in that, and the leading the change, because we all need to be leading this work, no matter who you are, especially leaders in companies, but all of us can lead the change in our work and really push for change in our companies. And then the last step is around transforming our companies, you know, really working on creating more inclusive and equitable systems in our companies, changing our industries, because we are all part of our industries as well, and we can all drive change there, and then our society in general, and the work that each of us can play in really moving the world toward a more equitable and inclusive world.
I mean, you really have laid out a blueprint for anyone to be able to lead from where they are, and I just really love that. And you can pick up your copy and learn more about how to be an ally at melindabriannaepler.com. Mm-hmm. What I really love, Melinda, is that you get to change the world with your husband, Wayne, that we talked about, Wayne Sutton. I love how you just lit up. whom I also adore. So can you share what it's like working closely with your husband?
Oh, I love it. And I will say that he literally just got back
home from a month-long ride across the country. If my face lit up just a little bit more, that's because he's finally home. And it's the longest we've ever been apart. But really briefly, his ride across the country was to raise awareness for mental health, specifically for Black and Brown men, and his work on the ICON project. So really, really important work. And it is a part of all of this, right? We have to create change so that no harm is done, and also repair harm that has been done too. And those are both equally important to change catalysts in the work that we do. So how does it working with us? I will say it's magical. Like, I mean, we are just in sync in so many different ways, and there's beautiful synergy in how we think and our work together. So, we have very different backgrounds and different backgrounds in terms of where we grew up. And I grew up in cities, you grew up in a very rural area in North Carolina, racial backgrounds, obviously. And then just in terms of our work history is very different too. And all of that, I think, is the beauty of diversity and diverse teams, right? And it has really shaped our work together in a beautiful way. I love working with him.
And it shows. It definitely shows. I mean, I know when I first met you guys at your first tech inclusion conference, and I saw you guys weren't yet married, but definitely couple goals, hashtag couple goals. But I did see that synergy. You know, like, I think it's so important when we choose our partners, and not just in life, but in the work that we do, and to have, I mean, how often do we see two change makers really fighting on the front lines for human equity and DEI spaces to come together and create a magnificent company and with initiatives that really fully support, you know, not just the Black and Brown experience, but the women and those who identify as women and, you know, marginalized communities. I just really applaud you guys for being able to create such synergy and keep moving initiatives forward, because especially in a pandemic, you know, where some people saw breakups, right, and dissolutions of companies and vision, you guys have been able to navigate through that and through some dark times too.
I think we're not alone. That it's been really difficult. It's been really challenging at a personal level and at a company level. Our team suffered ultimately. I'm really happy with how we have pivoted and that we've kind of doubled down on the ICON project, and we've doubled down on our training and coaching, and has really taken off. I think we're both happier as a result of it. But it's not been easy financially at all to do that for any business. And I mean, most small business has taken a hit.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely can resonate with everything you said, unfortunately. And I think, you know, it is a testament to the human spirit to be able to ride these waves.
With so much racial injustice and the real spotlight on that, and also the disparity in who is impacted and how people are impacted in the pandemic, and the number of Black men in particular that have died during the pandemic has been really hard. So I don't know that people outside of Black communities really know that, because it's hard to talk about. But that is something that we all, I think, and Indigenous communities as well, I will say, is Indigenous communities have been hit very hard globally. And we don't talk about it enough. We have lost a lot of Black men and one particular generation of amazing Black men. And I think that that's important for society to reflect on and take action on, so that doesn't happen moving forward. That is really important for us to recognize as a society.
You know, Melinda, I it is something that I've definitely reflected on and thought about. And I think part of it is that crushing weight of, as you mentioned, seeing generations of Black men being murdered, their livelihood taken away, their dignity, that lack of empowerment, and just stripping away the Black man. And it's a form of
slavery and abuse, to take a moment to pause and reflect on that is powerful and important. And I'd like to just take a moment right now and just sit with that. And I appreciate you for, you know, bringing that to the forefront, because, you know, at the end of the day, as we are watching our Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities lose their lives and livelihood, I mean, this pandemic has disproportionately affected us. You know, we're dying at higher rates due to COVID. We have lack of infrastructure and access to vaccinations and proper health care. I mean, this is really a defining moment for humanity to really step up for the rest of us who are being disproportionately affected, not just economically, but as you mentioned, you know, health-wise.
Yeah, and intergenerationally, because kids are being impacted by their parents getting sick and dying and losing their jobs and losing their businesses and their homes. I mean, it is more than even what the impact is right now. It's going to affect the next generation too.
You know, as we talk about this and as we reflect on hope, what is your hope for the future?
My hope for the future is that we all build a lot more empathy for each other. And not just having that empathy and holding that empathy, but acting on it and making decisions based on having empathy for each other. And not just empathy for the people that we know that are right in front of us, but people that are further out in our circles, people that aren't even in our circles, people that are in the next generation. You know, I am very passionate about climate equity and environmental justice, and the decisions that we make now are affecting the next generation and the next generation too. And so my hope is that we all build more empathy for humans in our life, outside of our life, that still in some way intersect with our decisions.
I co-sign to your vision for the future, Melinda. I am so here for that. Empathy is something that, you know, it really does need to be cultivated. And it's something that I value as well. It's a personal value system for myself. And I think the whole world would be in a much better place with more empathy, as well as vulnerability. You know, at Wonder Women Tech, we celebrate vulnerability as a superpower. So I would love you to share something with us that you've never shared with anyone before.
I will say that pre-pandemic, we had 2 air plants and now have probably 100 different plants.
Oh my gosh.
A lot of them air plants.
Wait, so you don't have to even water them. They're just living off of air?
No, they don't live in soil, but you just have to water air plants. And in fact, it doesn't take that much work if you just have a few air plants, but when you have a lot of air plants, then it becomes more of a production, because every week they have to be watered and dunked in water for somewhere between 20 minutes and 4 hours. So when you have that many plants, it actually becomes a production.
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, you have to actually schedule that on your calendar. Yeah. Yeah. Water the plants.
This is Sunday endeavor. I mean, it definitely, yeah, yeah. But it's, you know, we live in San Francisco where, and we have this beautiful view, and I'm very grateful for where we live. And also is very concrete. And so being inside a lot in the pandemic, we need a green around us. And so now we have a green around us.
So it's funny that you acquired all of these plants, and I actually am the opposite. I killed my succulents, not on purpose. I mean, it's just like I went out and also got greenery, thinking, you know, like I wanted to cheer my space, because I've been in the isolation by myself with my dog. So I did go out and get plants, but, and they're like, oh, I used to have a green thumb, but I do not know what has happened to me, but I'm not even kidding. I have killed succulents, like the kind that are not supposed to die, that you only you can even forget to water and they're not supposed to die, but mine have. So I applaud you.
Well, I think you need to go with a pathos or something that's super easy. But I'm sorry.
I've literally been told like, oh, this one, Lisa May, this one, you can't, it's impossible to kill these. Yeah, give it to me. Yeah, so I really admire your green thumb, and I wish I had it because my apartment does need some more greenery here, not just the financials. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
I'll take them all. You know, through the trials and the triumphs and the crazy winding road of life, looking back, would you take the easy road or the road less traveled, and why?
You know, I look back on multiple times in my life, I chose the harder road. And there have been several bifurcating paths along my journey. And each time I've taken the harder road, I think, and you know, sometimes I look back and think, well, should I have taken the path where I made a lot of money and then I could spend money and to create change that way? But I don't think I would have been happy doing that, honestly. I think that you know, creating impact and seeing the impact and seeing the results of that impact has been, it drives me forward. And I think some of us have to do it in order to have a world that continues to sustain itself and that sustains each other. So yeah, hard road it is for me.
I know. It's so interesting that you said that too. Like, you know, as you were talking, I'm thinking to myself, does creating systemic change automatically mean that you inherited a hard road, right? And you're right. And it's interesting because earlier this year, I got to spend time with Indigenous communities, part of my ancestral roots. And I spent time with the elders, and one of the elders that I was with told me that you're meant to till the soil. And so when you think about tilling the soil, it is like literally paving a path that no generation has walked on before. So that would be a hard road. So
yeah. And there's a lot of energy put into tilling the soil too.
A lot of energy, right? And you're not... And those of us who are tilling the soil, we don't necessarily see the crops immediately or if in our lifetime. So that's something to reflect on. You've given me something to think about.
Yeah, it's true. I think that we're not going to solve diversity, equity, and inclusion entirely in our lifetime. There's no way. So we are building for the future generations. Absolutely. I agree with you.
Yeah. Well, you are affecting change, and you are such a catalyst for the work that so much needs to be done on this planet. And I appreciate you for showing up, Melinda and Wayne, and just, you know, honestly, being authentic leaders. And we need more authentic leaders on the planet who have empathy, who are willing to be vulnerable, and who are willing to till the soil. So thank you so much, Melinda, for being with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I appreciate you and all the soil that you till as well. I'm glad we're doing it together.
Thank you so much for being here, innovators. Make sure you give us a like and share the podcast with your network. We'll see you next week when we take on the world one more time.